A fact-finding process in an era of fake news. Do the facts still matter? Some Texas takeaways from the impeachment hearing so far, coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. New guidelines for how the state tabulates ballots. Are we getting early warning signals about potential problems for 2020? Also, what can dogs tell humans about aging? Tech expert Omar Gayaga on winners and losers in the early volleys of the new streaming wars, plus a battle of the bands in Texas. On one side, pop music and fancy moves. On the other, what may be a dying tradition. All those stories and a whole lot more today on The Standard. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 14th day of November, 2019. I'm David Brown in the Texas capital city. Thanks so much for spending a bit of your Thursday with us. You got highlights of yesterday's kickoff of impeachment hearings in the U.S. House. You may have noticed how politicians on both sides of the aisle tried to get the witnesses to distill their sentiments into a soundbite. One of the witnesses, William B. Taylor, the top American diplomat in Ukraine, was ready. Whenever asked to inveigh on the president's guilt or offer an opinion on the process itself, Taylor replied with a canned response. I'm not here to take one side or the other. My sole purpose is to provide facts as I know them. It was a well-practiced line, to be sure, but one that is worth pondering in an era of what people call fake news. All fake news has something in common, of course. It's the news that doesn't comport with our own worldview. In such an environment, how much do the facts still matter? We may be about to find out as these hearings move forward. But for now, we're going to focus on the role of our own representatives in this process. Richard Pineda is the director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication at the University of Texas, El Paso. Professor, welcome back to The Standard.
Great to be here, David.
Four Texans on the House Intelligence Committee, part of these public hearings. Did any of these lawmakers add much to the tone or the direction yesterday?
I wouldn't say that there was a substantial change. I think the Republicans have done very well to fall in line, and I think you're seeing that across the Texas voices that are in the committee. Will Hurd, earlier before the committee, had talked about what standards he would apply in gauging the president's guilt, and one would have an assumption that Hurd's experience in the Central Intelligence Agency would give him some insight to foreign policy and policymaking. But it didn't really seem like we saw a lot of that yesterday. I think the Republicans on the committee, and certainly the president and his proxies, have really adopted a very defensive stance. And what we're seeing on social media is a full counteroffensive. And of course, the irony is that the president, when asked yesterday after his meeting with the Turkish prime minister, was to say that he wasn't paying attention and he didn't care. But the White House and the Trump Twitter account were really active yesterday. So right. So the sense is that even if they are trying to avoid getting into the minutiae of the testimony, that everyone really is on high alert.
Many Republicans on that committee, including Texan Mike Conaway, yielding their time to a Republican colleague, John Ratcliffe, who sort of stood out to many as an especially aggressive questioner in yesterday's hearing. Let's check out a sample. This is, once again, John Ratcliffe of Texas.
In this impeachment hearing today, where we impeach presidents for treason or bribery or other high crimes, where is the impeachable offense in that call? Are either of you here today to assert there was an impeachable offense in that call? Shout it out. Anyone?
Yeah, that was one of those moments that made it to a lot of highlight reels on YouTube and elsewhere. What do you make of that? Is that an illustration of what you were talking about there? Sort of Republicans trying to take a narrative that there's something wrong with the process?
Yeah, that's right. I think in the study of political communication, we look at the construction of narrative, and we talk about the idea of stories having fidelity and coherence. And I think the strategy there is to try to undermine fidelity. That is, if you tell a story and it is different than the experience that people have had, it starts to undermine that story. Mm-hmm. And I think the Republicans did very well in that sense yesterday, starting with Chair Nunez and working their way through even the Texas member, because I think that the sense is some of this evidence is pretty substantial, I think, pointing to the challenge for what the president has done. So I think the Republicans are going for essentially a legal strategy that says, listen, if there's the slightest bit of doubt in your mind, that means that you can't hold the president accountable. You know, there have been some great legal analysis over the last 24 hours that suggests that that's exactly what you would do if the evidence is so strong against your client. And I think the Republicans are following that memo.
Let's talk about a Democratic congressman from Texas, Joaquin Castro, trying to make the case that the president attempted bribery by allegedly asking the Ukrainian president to investigate Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, or else he wouldn't provide military aid to the country, this quid pro quo argument. Let's take a listen.
Is attempted murder a crime?
Attempted murder is a crime.
Is attempted robbery a crime?
Neither of us is a lawyer. But I
think anybody in this room could answer that question.
I think that's right. I'll go out on a limb and say, yes, it is.
Is attempted extortion and bribery a crime?
I don't know, sir.
Are we getting anything substantive out of these hearings, or is a lot of it sort of the push and pull trying to get witnesses to provide that that one big moment?
I think there's a combination, David. I think that the hope from the Democrats is to find some kind of break that makes it easy in their version of the narrative. So in that same way we were talking about fidelity, you want coherence, which is that the story makes sense and can be repeated. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a lot of dramatics. I mean, I think the very nature of the impeachment process is all about the drama. But I think what the Democrats have to be able to thread the needle on, and this is where it's going to get very tricky, the Democrats have to be able to make a story and use their legal counsel to put the crime together. But they have to be very cognizant that public opinion is going to follow all of this step by step. And so if that narrative lacks any coherence as it goes forward, the Democrats are going to have a very challenging time delivering on impeachment.
Richard Pineda is the director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication at the University of Texas, El Paso. Professor Pineda, as always, excellent insights, and we certainly do appreciate you taking time to speak with us on The Standard.
You're very welcome, David.
Well, you probably didn't think much about it at the time, but you know, the most recent election day, a couple of Tuesdays back, it was a kind of a test run for how ballots will be tallied in Texas in 2020. But as Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports, what happened in the state's most populous county might be a warning of sorts.
Election night last week turned out to be a late night in Harris County. It took almost 11 hours to report results. That's because things didn't go according to plan for the new county clerk, Diane Troutman.
It took a couple of months to build that process, and all the way, our county attorney was advising us that this was a perfectly legal process and per the election code.
Troutman's office had made some changes to the way the county transmits results, from a modem to an intranet network. But Paul Simpson, chair of the Harris County Republican Party, says those changes violated state election code.
Evidently, what the county clerk was going to do, and it may have done in May of 2019 without our knowledge, was connected to what they call an intranet, but it is an external network that can be connected and, you know, hacked into.
Not true, says Douglas Ray with the Harris County Attorney's Office, who signed off on Troutman's plan.
They asked me if it was legal. I looked at the statute and I said, okay, this transmission, is this an external communication network like the internet? They said, absolutely not.
Ray says the way he interprets things, the plan was secure and legal. Nonetheless, they had to change the plan dramatically after October 23rd, when early voters had already started casting ballots. The Texas Secretary of State had issued an advisory to all counties saying, if you want to transmit results electronically, then you need to make a copy first. Problem was, Harris County didn't have equipment to make those copies, and there wasn't enough time to get it. So that's why Troutman says, instead of her plan, they ended up using a process of physically transporting all the data to one location, then feeding all the cards through one machine, which took all night and into the morning.
The one that my predecessor used last November was over a cellular network, which is the internet. So he was violating this 10-year law that the Secretary of State brought up.
Her predecessor, Stan Stannert, was a Republican, and she believes the advisory from the state was a political move.
So it's curious to me why the Secretary of State started enforcing this law once I took office and not before.
And she thinks she knows what happened.
I believe it's common knowledge that the Secretary of State admitted to our county attorney that the Harris County Republican Party put pressure on the Secretary of State to make this last-minute advisory.
The advisory went out before the Republican Party was even involved.
That's Paul Simpson, the Harris County Republican Party chair.
To my knowledge, we didn't ask for any advisory.
Simpson says not only did Troutman's plan not comply with the law, it was also less secure than the prior system.
There had never been a problem. There's nobody can hack into that system.
But I talked with Dan Wallach, a computer science professor at Rice, who studied that system back in 2007.
We found that this particular modeming process was really not secure. And that has been used unmodified despite our findings for a decade.
He says Harris County is basically in a transition period.
The Harris County Clerk's Office is doing their best to maintain an ancient voting system, you know, to get it across the line through to 2020. And they've already started the ball rolling on purchasing a replacement system.
But Republican Party Chair Simpson is not on board with that because that replacement system uses paper ballots.
It can still be lost and distorted, as we know was the case back when we had paper ballots. And those of us who lived through the paper ballot days don't want to go back to them.
For now, there's a runoff election right around the corner. Early voting starts in a matter of weeks. On Monday night, the Harris County Republican Party passed a resolution, a no-confidence vote in Troutman. And they're calling on the Secretary of State to provide oversight of the runoff election, which is scheduled for December 14th. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are Texans talking about on this Thursday?
Hi, David. Some breaking news. First reported by the Texas Tribune, traveling fast across social media today. Democratic state lawmaker from West Texas, Representative Poncho Navarez, caught on surveillance footage at Austin's airport, apparently losing an envelope containing 2 grams of cocaine. The Tribune basing their reporting off a Texas Department of Public Safety affidavit stating that Navarez can be seen dropping an envelope that authorities later recovered, an official office envelope containing the baggies of cocaine. The representative offering a statement following the reporting, quote, "The news is true," he says. "I do not have anyone to blame but myself. I accept this because it is true and it will help me get better." On our Facebook page, Ed Scruggs calls it a tragic implosion, and Christopher Bailey says rather than hating on this man, we should be applauding his decision in fighting addiction. It's disgusting to me that so many in our culture revel in seeing people suffer. And obviously providing a little bit of context to his sudden announcement recently that he would not be seeking another term to represent the people of Eagle Pass there outside of El Paso.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd love to hear what you think of this story or anything else that's making news in your part of Texas. You know what to do, right? You get on your favorite social media platform and you reach out to us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, is looking for your comments, and he'll be back in about 35 with more of them.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, one of 17 U.S. universities with a land grant, sea grant, and space grant designation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
David Brown here with Business and Your Money on The Standard. Reuters reporting President Donald Trump expected to join Apple CEO Tim Cook on a visit to the Texas capital city next week. Both Apple and the White House mum about matters, but Reuters cite sources saying the event is supposed to showcase companies that keep jobs in America. Apple announced in September it would manufacture its new Mac Pro desktop computer in Austin. It would be the second such presidential trip to Texas in as many months. Back in October, Mr. Trump toured a new Louis Vuitton factory in Johnson County.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. They are as much a part of high school football in Texas as oversized mums, tailgate parties, and Frito pie. Those dazzling halftime performances in which high school bands take favorite pop songs and, with props and fancy dance steps, keep the crowds entertained during halftime. But what you might not have noticed is a dying tradition, perhaps out of step with modern times, but with a crisp and formal precision that dates back to the days of Sousa, and once associated with the grand old legacy of Texas marching bands. Texas Standard's Alexandra Hart listened in as one of them made what just might be a last stand of sorts at the Alamo Dome.
In San Antonio, 350 miles from home, the White Oak Marching Band gets ready for the performance of a lifetime. It may very well be one of the last one of these that they'll ever do. The band is among the last of a dying breed, an old guard of sorts when it comes to musical performance.
The only military band to qualify for the state marching contest, yes ma'am.
That's Jason Steele, White Oak's band director. He knows that it's been nearly 20 years since a band like his has won a state competition. You see, 94% of Texas marching bands competing nowadays are modern core style bands, which take a theatrical approach to marching routines that appeals to the masses, including the judges. It's a reality that even saw White Oak's band experimenting with moving away from its military roots to a fusion style sometimes called Millicore, an experiment that failed.
You could tell everyone was kind of like, this isn't what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be a military band. We're supposed to show everyone out there that military band can succeed.
Senior Caitlin Jester is the band's drum major. She says that year the band fell short and missed out on qualifying for state. Now they're back to doing what they do best.
And this year, it's just been really grateful to see everyone's hearts, and like they're so into this march. And they were going back to the traditional military marching, which was absolutely amazing. I love military marching. And it's slowly going away, and that's kind of sad.
Next year, the UIL, that's the body that governs high school competitions like this one, is creating a separate event for military bands as it updates its judging criteria. And while they'll technically be allowed to enter the general competition, changes to UIL's judging rubric will make it virtually impossible for military bands to remain competitive. So this is effectively White Oak's last hurrah against the flashy, more popular core bands. The night before the competition, Steele rallies his troops at their San Antonio hotel, reminding them what they're up against.
You're the only military here. You're going in a system that's built for everything but you. You're going into a way of thinking with people that have a predetermined idea of what they want to hear and see.
The next morning, White Oak begins their warm-ups at the Alamo Dome. At the same time, Assistant White Oak Band Director Randy Watley works with piccolo players Ethan Grammer and Caitlin Williamson on their solos. Now, White Oak knows that a well-executed piccolo solo can put a marching band over the top. A single piccolo, because of its high register, can stand out over an entire band. Nailing a solo like this one is crucial. And so, more than perhaps anyone else in the band, the piccolos need to be perfect. After the warm-ups, White Oak's 170 members line up on the sidelines as they wait for their turn to perform.
The next band in Conference 3A is the White Oak High School Marching Band.
They take their positions, and the drill begins. In 6 minutes, their performance is over, and the second-guessing begins. Many of the students, like Williamson, feel like it was far from their finest performance.
Not good.
Why not?
Because the piccolo solo was horrible. Yes. It was horrible. Because Ethan didn't play, and then I was out of step, and then I had to drop out a couple times, so it was just straight silence, because I was trying to get back in step.
Director Steele's take is a bit more generous.
I'm pretty good. We're pretty good. Just nervous. You know, you never know. I think they did a good job. Had a couple errors that we don't normally have, but...
White Oak has to be in the top 10 to advance to the final round. And with the errors, nobody's quite sure what to expect.
The 10 bands that will advance to tonight's final round.
They take the stands as judges begin announcing the finalists.
15, the White Oak High School Marching Band.
They made the cut, but just barely. They're in 10th place. But Steele sees this as an opportunity. He gathers his band for one last pep talk.
Now, I've always been happy whenever I hear finals announcements,
But I've never been more happy standing. I was down on the field, actually, for it. I've never been more happy hearing you guys shout whenever you got in the finals, because it was a genuine surprise.
In 10th place, there's nowhere to go but up as they take the field one last time. White Oak's final performance goes off without a hitch, even that tricky piccolo solo. It was the magic performance that Steele says he's been waiting for all season long.
That's exactly how you want to finish.
How are you feeling after this one compared to the last one?
I feel a whole lot better after this one. First one, I'm going to be honest with you, we had enough little marching errors that I didn't think we would make the finals, so I'm just glad we were in it.
Now the band waits to see if the judges see it that way.
In 9th place, please congratulate the Crane High School Marching Band.
And with each successive announcement, the band looks more and more surprised.
In 4th place, please congratulate the White Oak High School Marching Band.
White Oak's final performance moves the Little Military Band from East Texas up 6 whole spots. It's the highest the band has ever finished in its 5 appearances at the state marching competition. Steele is pleased with the come-from-behind climb in what's likely their final state contest, competing as outsiders against core bands.
This was the last shot. Now they're going to start a separate contest, UIL sanctions, just for militaries, which is going to be a cool thing, and we'll see how that goes. But as far as down here in the Alamo Dome and competing with everybody else, this was it. This was the last one.
As the band celebrates on field with hugs and a few tears, it's a fitting, though bittersweet, end of an era. In San Antonio, I'm Alexandra Hart for the Texas Standard.
Alexandra worked with multimedia journalist Julia Reese, based at her home station, KUT Austin, to get some great photos and video of the band competition. You got to check this out, texasstandard.org.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. State Representative Pancho Nevarez is confirming to the Texas Tribune he decided not to seek re-election in 2020 because he had an envelope with cocaine on him while traveling through a Texas airport. The Eagle Pass Democrat was caught on surveillance footage in September dropping the envelope while leaving Austin Bergstrom International Airport. It contained 4 small clear baggies with a white powdery substance that tested positive for cocaine. The El Paso Walmart, where 22 people were killed in a mass shooting targeting Mexicans, reopens today. The store has been closed since the August 3rd attack. KERA's Mallory Falk reports.
The renovated store will include an outdoor memorial to the victims, with 22 aluminum pillars joining together to form a large candle-like structure. Deborah Anchondo's younger brother, Andre, was killed inside the Walmart. She says she may visit the memorial, but not very often.
Honestly, it's my brother. He lives in my memory every day, so if I'm going to go somewhere, it would be to his graveside.
But Anchondo says she's glad the store is reopening. She's ready to see the site filled with people again. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
A federal appeals court is reversing a ruling that Texas is violating the National Voter Registration Act. The plaintiffs in the case argue the Department of Public Safety treats an in-person change of address differently than if someone updates their driver's license online. Last year, a trial court agreed, but the Fifth Circuit took issue with whether the plaintiffs should be affected by the rule. Mimi Marciani is with the Texas Civil Rights Project.
We are disappointed in this technical ruling by the Fifth Circuit. Nothing in it goes against the facts that are happening on the ground and the fact that the state of Texas time and time again tries to make voting and voter registration more difficult.
Currently, online voter registration is illegal in Texas. The Texas State Board of Education is moving closer to approving its first African American Studies course. The 15-member group is considering a curriculum that was developed and approved for Dallas ISD schools this year. Dallas high school student Jada Shivers told the board during a hearing Wednesday, taking this class has helped her better understand the African American experience.
Specifically, the coursework emphasizes that African American culture and identity did not begin with slavery. This has been significant in developing my cultural perspective because it has provided me more information about my forefathers.
The board approved its first ethnic studies course last year, Mexican American Studies. They're expected to sign off on the African American Studies course in 2020. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As we all get older, we often tend to focus more on the stuff once overlooked. You know, conversations about things like bone density loss, ditto changes in vision and hearing, matters of memory. But what do we know about the effects of aging when it comes to our pets? Well, changing that is one of the goals behind the Dog Aging Project. It's a collaboration between Texas A&M and the University of Washington. Daniel Promislow is in Texas from Seattle, and he is co-director of the Dog Aging Project and leader of a nationwide study on companion dogs, too. Professor Promislow, welcome to the Texas Standard Studios.
I'm delighted to be here.
And to Texas in general. So you're in town because your team is presenting at the Gerontological Society of America conference in Austin this week. Gerontological, did I say that correctly then?
You did.
Amen.
That's right. Study of aging.
So why do those who study human aging care about what happens to dogs as they age?
Dogs are an ideal model to study aging in. First of all, dogs are the most variable species on the planet. Just go to the dog park, compare a Great Dane and a Chihuahua, mm-hmm. a poodle, a dachshund, just so much variation. Well, they also vary in the diseases that they get and how long they live. And the cool thing is, not so good for the dogs, but interestingly, they get the same diseases that we do. They get heart disease and cancer and kidney disease, neurological diseases. And age, just like in humans, is the single greatest risk factor for all of those diseases. Of course, in dogs, everything is happening much faster.
Mm-hmm, right.
So we can learn about the biological factors and the environmental factors that shape aging much more faster in dogs than we can in humans.
I think a lot of people would wonder just how useful of an analog a dog is to a human, right? I mean, there's not a direct correlation per se, right? I mean,
there's actually a really direct correlation between dogs and humans in the causes of aging. A lot of what we know about human aging, we've actually learned from lab organisms like mice and mm-hmm. worms. Mm-hmm. Biologically, the same things that are going on in us are going on in dogs. Dogs live in our environment. So if we can discover the environmental factors that influence healthy aging in dogs, they're likely to influence us as well.
Is there anything particular in the course of your research that you found that you believe was particularly striking, maybe something that people might be interested in hearing about?
One of the things that a graduate student in my lab discovered: in dogs, those that are intact are more likely to die of infectious disease or trauma, and those that are spayed or neutered are more likely to die of cancer and autoimmunity.
Why do you think that is?
We don't know for sure. One possibility is that dogs that are intact that have their sex hormones are more likely to reproduce. They're also more likely to roam, and they may be exposed to infectious diseases.
Interesting.
May be exposed more to the risk of being hit by a car, for example.
How much do we know about the effects of aging on canines?
We know quite a bit. We know that age affects the risk of all kinds of diseases in dogs. We know that there are very long-lived dogs, especially the smallest breeds, the dachshunds and the Pomeranians and the toy poodles live for a long time. The Great Danes and the Bouviers tend to be much shorter lived. But what we don't know a lot about yet is which genes are determining why some breeds are short-lived and some are long-lived. And we certainly don't know a lot yet about the environmental factors. And we're hoping in the Dog Aging Project, with the help of thousands of citizen scientists around the country, to learn about the biological and the environmental factors.
Say more about the citizen scientists aspect of this.
So the Dog Aging Project is a study of 10,000 dogs all around the country, people's dogs in their homes. Mm-hmm. And we're going to work with those people. So if you have a dog, you can go to dogagingproject.org. Mm-hmm. You can go there today. We're launching today. You can sign up your dog and you will be a part of the Dog Aging Project. You will help us do science. You will help us learn about the factors that affect aging in dogs for the rest of the life of your dog.
Sounds like what's really missing in a lot of this research are the data points.
That's right. No one has ever carried out a study this big of thousands and thousands of dogs looking at aging.
Can anyone do this? And any dog?
We welcome all breeds, mixed breed and purebred, mm-hmm. all ages, males and females in every state in the country, urban, suburban, rural. So all across Texas, we would love for dog owners to sign up their dog.
We'll link to the particulars over at our own website, texasstandard.org. Daniel Promislow is co-director of the Dog Aging Project and leader of a nationwide study on companion dogs, working with researchers from Texas A&M on this particular endeavor. Thank you so much for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios. Good to meet you, Dr. Promislow.
Delighted to be in Texas and to be here speaking with you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. The sound approach to lung cancer prevention is to avoid smoking and tobacco products while working toward a healthy lifestyle. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Hey, it's a Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. From Heel to Toe is our project wherein Texans talk about their boots because, as we've learned in collecting some of these stories, sometimes our boots have an artistic value. Sometimes they reflect the work we do, and sometimes our boots say something about our roots.
My name is Larry Callis. I have the Black Cowboy Museum in Roseburg, Texas. I'd like to tell the listeners why I talk like I do. I have something called vocal dysphonia. I used to be a country and western singer. George Strait's manager was my manager at one time, but I lost my voice 25 years ago. Some of the artifacts I have a badge that was dated back in 1858. It says, Slave Patrol, Police. It was one of the first badges ever made. I have a carving of a slave from 1850. They brought two slaves to Rosenberg. One was a woman and one was a young man. They split them up and he missed his mom so much he carved her face out of a tree. Also, I have a pair of my grandpa's boots. My grandpa's boots were from 1930. They're brown. They have two eagles on them. They were made in Mexico. They're pointy-toed, you know, like they had back in the day. He was a small man, and they're a little bit small for me, but I can put them on. He was a singer. He used to sing in church. He played guitar. He used to call me Doc. That was the most thing I remember him. He said, hey, Doc, you want to go to the store with me? And I would stand up on his 1955 Chevy. It was a brand new Chevy. And I would stand up on the seat right next to him, and he'd drive all the way back. That was back when we didn't have to have seat belts. He used to wear those boots, and I just remember I wanted a pair of boots like that. And finally, my mom, when I turned 5 years old, bought me a pair of red boots with, I think mine had doves on it, but my grandpa's had eagles. The Black Cowboy was the first cowboy. Back in the 1820s, they had slaves that worked the cows. And they would say, hey, boy, go get that cow. Hey, boy, go get that cow. And they start saying, that's my cowboy. They had a house boy, a yard boy, and somebody worked cows. He was called a cowboy. And they were the first cowboys. And they were from Fort Bend County, down in Rosenberg.
That's Larry Callis, owner of the Black Cowboy Museum in Rosenberg, Texas. What's your boot story? Email us, won't you, at texasstandard@kut.org, because who knows? Your boots may do the talking in an upcoming episode. The streaming wars are officially on. Disney Plus launching Tuesday. Apple TV Plus made its debut on November 1st. Disney's been cross-promoting its service really aggressively on its other platforms like ESPN and elsewhere. The House of Mickey says 10 million people signed up on the first day to watch stuff like Marvel and Pixar movies, Star Wars, The Simpsons. So, does the reigning king of streaming have something to worry about? Our tech expert, Omar Gayaga, has been tuning in and turning on. Hello there, Omar. Good to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
So you've checked out Disney Plus.
Oh, yeah. I paid for the 3-year in advance.
Wow. Early adopter, as they say in the tech world.
Well, I like to save money.
Were they offering discounts, heavy discounts?
For some, they did a D23 special member thing, and then they did another thing that was like, I think, $40 off for 3 years. Okay. But, you know, I feel like it's going to be around a while just based on the strength of its launch. I have kids. It's like, if you have kids and they like Disney, like, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but I'm wondering if it's more for people who, like, have kids. I mean, your Disney brand is obviously synonymous. Or if it's, like, a lot of rerun. I mean, is it rerun-centric?
It's both. I think me as a very cynical, jaded TV streaming person, I think a lot of us were just surprised by how robust it is right out of the gate. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on there. And it's not just kids' movies. It's not just animation. It's also National Geographic. It's also a lot of the Marvel movies. It's also a ton of Star Wars stuff. It's being able to watch the Star Wars movies in 4K for the first time on a streaming service. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here, not to mention the original stuff that's new, like The Mandalorian, which is a Star Wars live-action series.
Wow.
There's a High School Musical kind of reality thing. There's just a lot of new stuff mixed with a lot of Vault archive type stuff.
I understand The Mandalorian's been getting some pretty good reviews, too.
It's good. It's fun. It's only the first episode, so we haven't really seen where it's going, but there's some surprises in it. There's a lot of callbacks. It's written by Jon Favreau.
Cool.
It's quite good, yeah.
So I guess this brings us to the question of Netflix, and you've been writing about Netflix recently. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably safe to say that for most people, Netflix is the go-to service. Should they be shaking in their boots?
Netflix has a really strong position because generally if people are subscribing to 2 or 3 or 4 streaming services, Netflix is in that mix. They're usually like number one and then something else, maybe Hulu or CBS All Access or something like that. I think what's going to happen right now is it's going to be Netflix and maybe Disney Plus and maybe one other one. But the problem I'm seeing that Netflix has had is just a lot of mediocre content. If you just kind of scroll through Netflix and see some of their original movies, some of their original series, there's some gems, and then there's a lot of stuff that you're never going to watch or stuff that you've watched and you're just like, it's kind of not.
You know, but this is kind of starting to get expensive. You mentioned Netflix and maybe one other or something. I think for a lot of folks, we've already sort of jumped the shark here when it comes to how much we're spending on different services. Mm-hmm. You got Amazon Prime that's already been out there. You've got Apple TV Plus, which launched earlier this month. Mm-hmm. You've got the Disney. You've got your Netflix. Another service based in Dallas, Texas. You've got HBO Max, which is coming from AT&T. Mm-hmm. All right. So at some point, this starts to be more expensive than. I mean, I haven't even mentioned Hulu. I mean, a bunch of them are coming to mind. You know how this works. I mean, people will end up just sort of subscribing because they want to see that movie right then.
It gets to be as expensive as cable.
Thinking it just might,
I think that's what's going to happen. But I think what the streaming companies are doing that's kind of smart is they are bundling things. They are saying like, okay, if you're already an HBO DirecTV subscriber, you're going to get HBO Max for free. If you just bought an iPhone, you're going to get Apple TV Plus for a year.
Sort of leveraging their other positions in other markets.
Right. And if you're a Verizon customer, you're going to get a year of Disney Plus, at least to sample it and try it out. I think what a lot of people will start to do is kind of hop among these. They will spend a month or two, you know, kind of devouring as much as they can on one of these and then jump to another one, devour whatever new originals are there, and then stop it for a while. But it requires a lot of management. You got to juggle a lot of these things around.
Well, Omar Gayaga has been keeping his eyes on the new streaming wars. You can find out the latest at TechMinuteTexas.com. Good to see you, Omar. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me. Happy viewing.
Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time's a whole lot more ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at TexasChildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. At Cook Children's Medical Center in Fort Worth, a 9-month-old child named Tinsley Lewis is being treated for a rare heart condition called an Epstein anomaly, chronic lung disease, and chronic hypertension. She has spent her entire life in the hospital connected to life support, without which she would likely die. But officials for the hospital say they've done everything they can for the child and plan to disconnect her from the machines keeping her alive, despite the protests of Tinsley's family. On Sunday, a judge ruled that the hospital must continue treating her until November 22nd, during which time Tinsley's family will try to find another facility where she can be treated. For more on the legality and ethics governing this story, we bring in Tom Mayo. He is a medical ethicist and professor of law at the SMU Dedman School of Law. Professor Mayo, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What allows the hospital to legally do this, to say we are going to pull the plug on life support for this child, even though the parents don't want that to happen?
Right. Well, ethically, of course, medicine reaches the end of the road for everybody, where there's just nothing left for a medical professional to do other than to prepare for the end. In 1999, the Texas legislature passed a statute, the Texas Advanced Directives Act. We have a provision in there that says that if there is a dispute over treatment that the physicians regard as inappropriate or futile, then there's a process that we can go through. And that process includes consultation with the Hospital Ethics Committee, which, if the Ethics Committee agrees with the doctor, there's a 10-day period for trying to find another institution that will accept transfer. And if no transfer can be arranged, then there's no further obligation to continue the treatment.
Well, so who determines whether a patient's treatment is futile? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you have the parental interests here. You have what is the interest on the doctor's side, the hospital side?
Well, the statute, to begin with, does not have a definition of futility, and in fact, the word futility or futile doesn't appear in the statute. When the AMA came out with their statement, the American Medical Association, around 1999. On medical futility, they didn't offer a definition either. And so part of the problem with the term is that there is a fairly wide spectrum of meanings that people assign to the concept of futility. And then there's just a question of where do we go from here? But we can't just keep doing this forever and ever.
But if in fact it does maintain a life, even if it's not a quality of life that would be desirable by someone else, I mean, some would argue that is sufficient because, as we've all seen from time to time, remarkable things can and have happened.
That's absolutely right. And that's where the disagreements start and they go from there. Is mere biological existence without consciousness, without interactions with people and the environment around you, is that something that the medical profession should devote itself to sustaining?
For some people, that simply is an example of futility.
Let me ask one other question. This is a hard one to ask because it sounds cynical, but there's a child who's taking up a lot of resources at that hospital. And I suppose if I were in that child's family, especially under those conditions, I might, the thought might occur to me that it's just costing too much to keep this child alive, and decisions are being made about sustaining the life of this child because someone's taking up a bed or a ventilator. Is that just part of an inherent part of the truth of healthcare today?
Well, I'd be lying if I said that there's no concern about limited resources in the healthcare system. But I think want to emphasize very clearly for listeners that costs do not come into the ethics discussions of these cases. We don't know who's insured and who's not insured. And frankly, I think we shouldn't. Whether limitations on treatment in the long run save the system money or not, I think the jury's still out on that, to be perfectly honest.
Tom Mayo is a medical ethicist and law professor at the SMU Dedman School of Law. Professor Mayo, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We sure do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, let's find out what Texans are talking about on social media. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from friends and listeners about that difficult story we just heard, how that baby on life support in Fort Worth is highlighting Texas' 10-day rule governing end-of-life decisions. Mm-hmm. Lots of people chiming in. One comment on our Facebook page here from Rachel Anthony. She calls it a sad situation for both sides. We go to Cook Children's, the hospital in question, on a regular basis, and the staff there is amazing. I'm 100% positive the hospital has done everything they could for the child. So again, a story that I'm sure we'll be hearing more about in the days to come.
Right.
While referring to another story from earlier in the show, I discussed this earlier, the Representative Pancho Navarez confirming this report by the Texas Tribune that he is seen on airport security footage dropping an envelope that apparently contained 2 grams of cocaine. And I made a little bit of a mistake. We got a listener email. Someone wrote in saying, if I heard correctly during the story, it was mentioned Eagle Pass, where he represents, is in the vicinity of El Paso. Please consult a map.
Yes.
If I'm in error, please ignore. And it did indeed Eagle Pass, closer to Del Rio there
indeed.
In the valley. But again, another developing story that people are talking about. While shifting gears, gossip website TMZ. Have you seen this, David?
That, I don't frequent TMZ, but
well,
I've heard of it.
Maybe you should, yeah, because they have an interesting little story here. Apparently one Kanye West, fresh off his Jesus is King album, is bringing his so-called Sunday service to Joel Osteen's Houston megachurch.
Well, how about
Sunday.
That?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's now that's two high-profile individuals
that
right
is
there.
One way to put it. For
yeah.
Sure.
Well, I was trying to, you know, be neutral about these things. So Kanye West and Joel Osteen.
Yes, definitely.
At the big church there in Houston.
Yeah, lots of people chiming in about this one, as you might imagine. Via Twitter, Jay asks, is Kanye doing his best 1980s Dylan impersonation? I guess referring to when the singer-songwriter found religion there. Did he just watch Walk Hard? Is that what's happening? I guess that's that what that lampooning a parody of sort of musical film tropes there. And of course, you know, getting religion, one of them. Via Facebook, rather, Brittany Lalu, she says, Houston is full. Do not come here. And an interesting point of view to consider, she adds. Joel Osteen opened his doors faster to Kanye West than he did for flood victims, there to this controversy over whether or not his church rapidly opened their doors quickly enough.
How rapidly,
during Hurricane Harvey there in Houston, Texas. Meanwhile, back on Twitter, OB says, who cares? This is dope. Referring to Kanye's decision to bring the Sunday service there to H-Town. So definitely should be interesting. Apparently, what I saw on the gossip website there is that I think he's going to maybe sit down, have a sort of sermon-like, you know, conversation with Osteen, and then they're going to have the music later that night. So it should be a sort of all-day affair down there in H-Town.
Yeah, so I'm reading here, the Sunday service expected to attract record crowds. That's going to be quite a spectacle, assuming that that goes forward, and we trust it. Well, we're going to keep you posted on this story and a whole lot of other things that are happening in the news at texasstandard.org. And, of course, we'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us one way or the other. On behalf of the entire Texas Standard crew, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.